I thought what I would do today as a framework for what we'll discuss is to read from and comment on the first few of the 10 Oxfording pictures, which I think most of you have heard of. They're very famous in Zen annals. No one knows exactly how and when and who originated them, but it is known that they probably began sometime around or shortly after the Tang Dynasty and were modified, initially only being five of them, and I think today I'm going to go through the first five, if we have time. And then they increased to eight and then to 10. I'm going to be reading from the 10 ox herding pictures as they appear in the Three Pillars of Zen. I think they're very useful. They're a little bit structured, but they point out certain critical steps along the way. And most of the time when I talk to all of you, I talk about these steps because I think we need to be very particular and painstaking about not skipping anything, really going straight directly to the source. So just as a way of starting this off, I will quote something that I've said many times. I haven't said it in a while, but it's a famous saying in Zen. There's nothing in particular to realize. Just give up, let go of the notion of Buddhas and sentient beings. There's nothing in particular to realize. Just let go of the notion of something you're not and something others that you might put on giant pedestals are. That's a critical point. Now I'm going to read the first ox herding picture. So, the first one, there's beautiful paintings, which obviously I can't show you all. The ones that I'm looking at are made out of some kind of black ink, like a calligraphy. Beautiful paintings. This is a man in a monk's robe, looking around anxiously in the woods. And it goes like this. Seeking the ox. The ox has never gone astray, so why search for it? Remember what we said. Having turned his back on his true nature, the man cannot see it. Because of the defilements, I'm having a little trouble reading this. I'm going to turn the light up a little because I'm getting old and going apart. When I give these talks in the evening, I'm usually wearing my glasses, but today I'm wearing my contacts, and I don't read quite as well with them. Okay, so because of his defilements, he has lost sight of the ox. Okay, so this is the ox herding pictures. They're talking about this thing, and they capitalize the O, the ox. What is this ox? What is it? Suddenly, he finds himself confronted by a maze of crisscrossing roads. Greed for worldly gain and dread of loss spring up like searing flames. Ideas of right and wrong dart out like daggers. The human condition. And then there's a beautiful poem here, and each one of these is followed by a poem, and I'll read that. Desolate through forests and fearful in jungles, he is seeking an ox which he does not find. Up and down dark, nameless, wide-flowing rivers, in deep mountain thickets, he treads many bypaths. Bone-tired, heart-weary, He carries on his search for this something which he just cannot find. At evening, he hears cicadas chirping in the trees. So, this is our state when we conceive of the world as something containing opposites, right and wrong, good and bad, and all these things are valid to some extent. But remember, we're looking for the ox. We're not just looking for worldly understanding, for getting all our ducks lined up in a row. Because even when you line them all up, sooner or later they go out of line, they fall down. Can't keep them in that line forever and ever. It's a basic truth in Buddhism. So we are beset with thinking, judgment, naming, comparing. We do it with others, we do it with ourselves. We get stuck here. We don't know how to get out of it. It's like a morass. So the Buddha said, life is dukkha. We talked about the Four Noble Truths the last time we spoke. The first two of them are life is suffering. And the cause of suffering is desire. Now, what is this desire? It's that things should be some way different than they actually are in this moment. They ought to be different. Now, where do we get that idea? That things ought to be different than they are exactly as they are right now. We learned it along the way. And learning involves thinking, and thinking involves the creation of ideas and concepts that get layered on the world. The actual innocent world that couldn't be other than what it is right now. And we get caught in the thinking. And then we have preferences. So like Zengsan, the third Zen patriarch, said in the Xinjin Ming, translated by our late teacher Richard Clark, beautiful translation. Very first thing he said is, the great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. So this thing, this ox that we're seeking, it's not difficult if you're not attached to what? Thinking. That's what preferences are. They're thinking. The thinking goes very deep. This is not some simple little superficial thing. Deep habit patterns, deep attachments. We built them up in Buddhism, they say, over many, many lifetimes. They talk about beginningless ignorance. So this is a rather old and ancient tradition of very direct pointing. Now in modern times, we have something called psychotherapy. It's very useful. It actually points at some of these things. This man lost in the woods, thoughts darting out, right and wrong, left and right, good and bad, I should, I shouldn't, if only I was this way, I'm just a sentient being, they're Buddhas, I'm not a Buddha, all these things. So I listened to this podcast yesterday, it was very, very interesting, it was about thoughts, it got me considering ox herding pictures and maybe using them as a framework, but it talked about thoughts and the approach to thinking in terms of psychotherapy in the West. And one of the approaches, and probably the earliest one, was the Freudian approach or the approach of analysis, of trying to understand where the thoughts came from. So you have a thought about wanting to do harm to somebody, and they analyze all the way back to the very beginning when you were a child and what something someone said to you and what you did and how you felt and how that led to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. This is a certain kind of psychotherapy and it's not invalid. Why? I'm just going to bring it very quickly back to what we're doing here. There is a validity and it can be very healing to see these connections because of one thing. You realize that everything the way it is right now is a product of everything the way it was, step by step by step. This is called karma. So this moment, the way it appears, is the result of inevitable causes and conditions, one by one, from the beginning of time until now. So you see that clearly in this particular practice. You see that clearly. You see that it couldn't have been any different. It could only have been this way. Then the whole notion of a preference, an idea, a name, or whatever, begins to seem futile and irrelevant. It couldn't have been any other way. And now we begin to consider the possibility of simply letting things be as they are, which could be called embracing, but it's the kind of embracing that gives space rather than holds on to. Now, this approach of psychotherapy doesn't work for everybody. And there was someone who came up with something new. And he had somebody who was continually fearful that he was going to kill his wife and became very obsessed about this. Even though he was a highly moral person, he saw some horrible movie and it created a terrible fear, and all of a sudden he had these obsessive thoughts. I'm going to kill my wife, I'm going to slash her, and horrible, horrible thoughts. And this particular therapist worked with people with this type of thing by gradually desensitizing them, and in this particular case, had a big, giant, sharp knife in his office, put it in the guy's hand, and had the guy gradually, this took a long time, maybe several months, put the knife right to the therapist's neck and realize that he could never do such a thing, that this thought was wrong. And this became one of the root experiences in something that was called cognitive behavioral therapy, is to see that the thought is actually incorrect. You undermine it. You realize it's the thought is there, but you don't have to believe it. You don't have to take it seriously. And sometimes it takes a very drastic, dramatic approach like this for someone to suddenly get it, that really the problem is not that they might hurt somebody, but they have such strong moral resistance to ever doing such a thing that they torment themselves over it. This is a highly moral person who could never do such a thing. And when he got that, he was cured almost instantly. It's another way of dealing with thinking. Then what's evolved over the past few years is something called a third wave, and I found this very interesting in this podcast. Talked about a new approach where they called it the mindful approach, where you realize that thoughts arise constantly and that you don't have to pay attention to them at all. You don't have to understand where they came from. You don't have to contradict them in any way, seeing that they're actually incorrect and that there's a truth that's almost the opposite of that particular thought. You can simply say, it's just a thought. It's like a cloud. And bring yourself back to your actual concrete experience. That's actually what we do here. We're doing the third wave. That's really the essence of Zazen. Almost every step of the way is to, first of all, see that thoughts have a meaning that is irrelevant. Because if things are already complete in this moment, they couldn't be any different than they are. Then any particular thought that is judging, pushing, clinging, any of the thoughts that come from what we call the three poisons, which is clinging to something, holding on to it, wanting to be a certain way, rejecting something that's in your actual experience right now, or making some story about it, is utterly, completely irrelevant. Irrelevant. Now, what does this first Oxfording picture say? It's pointing at something here, pointing at it. So it says, he's searching for this thing you can't find, and at evening, he hears cicadas chirping in the trees. What is that? There's cicadas chirping in the trees. They're pointing at something. There's something. Something is there. The thought is there. The thought is like cicadas chirping in the trees. All these thoughts of right and wrong that we torment ourselves over. All the things we attach to. If we understand that they're irrelevant, their meaning is irrelevant, they become like cicadas chirping in the trees. They're there, but they're just chirping. Just like a sound, just like a smell, just like a sensation. Now we can begin to see thinking as no different than anything else. It has its reasons. It's not disconnected. It just is. Just is. And we bring ourselves back to our actual experience. Yes, the thought is there. And we continue with the breath. Yes, the thought is there, and we continue with mu, or shikantaza, the ever continuous awareness of the moment by moment, done sensations. This is the very first step. So the first step in this practice is to learn to disentangle from the stickiness of thinking. This is an essential point. So we take the third wave. We hold to our awareness of something actual, the actual breath, the actual sounds, smells, sensations, the actual deep question, mu or hu, whatever it might be that your particular practice is. We hold to that, the actual. And then from this standpoint, we see thoughts coming in. And we let go of the meaning because the meaning is irrelevant. This is done. Any thought about it is irrelevant. It's not going to change what's done. I'm in the present moment. I'm in reality. I'm not dealing with the future or the past. I'm here right now in this actual experience. So any idea about it, any concept, maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong, but it's irrelevant. So now I can just see it as sensation of thinking. Sensation of thinking. Cicadas chirping in the trees. Exactly like that. I've begun to unstick myself. Let's go to the second ox herding picture. So this one is called Finding the Tracks. And it goes like this. Though the sutras and teachings, through the sutras and teachings, he discerns the tracks of the ox, the tracks. He has been informed that just as different shaped golden vessels are all basically of the same gold. I'm having a little trouble reading this. Each and everything is a manifestation of the self with a capital S. So I'm going to read that again. Through the sutras and teachings, he discerns the tracks of the ox. He has been informed that just as any different shaped golden vessels are all basically of the same gold, so each and everything is a manifestation of the self with a capital S. Remember how we've talked about this over and over again. So the thinking is what is making distinctions between things. Distinctions of good and bad, better and worse. Buddhas and sentient beings. This is all created by thinking. All the differences we see, all the names of things that create dividing lines, that separate things, separate us from others. But every single thing is made of something the same. And here it's called gold. All these different vessels are made of this. What is this thing that everything is made of? And then the word self with a capital S appears. Self. What is this self? Let's go on. But he is unable to distinguish good from evil, truth from falsity. He has not actually entered the gate, but he sees in a tentative way, the tracks of the ox, the tracks of the ox. So it's still an idea, but it's not unimportant. The teachings create what is called view. The view points us in a certain direction. That's why when you hear a teacher talking about something, even though it may not be your direct experience, it's bringing your mind towards something that you would have otherwise ignored, perhaps, or maybe only stumbled over a long time later, after you've finally let go of all the thoughts that have layered over reality. So this is tentative but not unimportant. It's a very important step to learn how to point your mind. So here it says, the poem, innumerable footprints he has seen in the forest along the river's edge. Over yonder, does he see the trampled grass? Even in the deepest gorges of the topmost mountains, these cannot hide the ox's nose, which reaches right to heaven. So basically, it's saying that we are dimly aware of it, but there's something that resonates in a deep way. And this is the difference between what one might call belief, which is holding to an idea that contradicts your reality in a profound way, your intelligence, and faith, which is resonating with something that you already know. Remember that statement that I first said. There's nothing in particular to realize. Just let go of the notion of Buddhas and sentient beings. There's nothing in particular that anyone lacks, were they simply to put down the idea of lacking, the concept of lacking. So when you hear these words, you say, yes, that has to be true. It resonates. If it didn't resonate, you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be doing this practice. So this is the difference between belief, which is being told something outrageous, contradicts science, contradicts your intelligence, creates a fantasy, what we call magical thinking, and someone pointing at something that we're dimly aware of, but that has to be true. This is what faith is. This draws you. It's almost like the gravitational pull, something very powerful, gradually pulling you into the awareness, because it's not contradicting what you know in your deepest self. So this is so important. We start from a notion of self with a small s. This is where we create Buddhas and sentient beings. We feel that we are an entity with characteristics. These characteristics make something inside separate from everything else, peering out at an outside world. This is how we start. This is the man walking through the forest, fearful, hearing sounds and being pulled left and right. And we begin to, in this practice, through putting down our thoughts, the meaning of them, seeing their sensation, seeing that the sensation of a thought is essentially not different than the sensation of a sound, sensation of something visual, sensation of a body, sensation of emotions and feelings. These are all sensory, and that in each moment they're done. And yet they show something. They shine something. They have a presence. They are. We begin to realize that this is this gold underlying all the differences, all the changes and differences and distinctions that the mind makes, peering out at a world that seems to be outside, attaching to certain things that it identifies with as a small self. But what is this self with a capital S? What is it? What is it? We'll go on to this third picture. So this one is called The First Glimpse of the Ox. If he will but listen intently to everyday sounds, he will come to realization and at that instant see the very source, with a capital S, the very source. The six senses are no different from this true source, with a capital S. In every activity, the source is manifestly present. It is analogous to salt in water or binder in paint. It's thoroughly dissolved. When the inner vision is properly focused, one comes to realize that that which is seen is identical with the true source. And then there's a poem. A nightingale warbles on a twig. The sun shines on undulating willows. There stands the ox. Where could it hide? That splendid head, those stately horns. What artist could portray them? What picture could you make of this? What idea could you have about it? And the picture here is a smudge that looks like a tree, and suddenly the rear end of an ox appears very, very clearly. This is the tentative kind of first glimpse of the ox. You could call it a kind of Kensho awakening experience. Not thorough, because we stand apart from it. And we understand, we get something that's very direct, very basic, very, when you see it, obvious. And yet we somehow stand apart from it. We haven't really understood that the dividing line between what I call myself and the world is just made up in thought. It's completely created by thinking. So what is this thing that we see? What is this gold? What is this self? What is this source? When we see it clearly, realize that everything is emanating this same am, presence. Things simply are. They shine this, they emanate it. This is the beginning of perceiving this ox. The beginning. Now we get here by going very directly in our zazen into our actual experience. Any thought that arises, we drop the meaning. We just feel a sensation and just farm it in with the practice. Go back to the actual sensation of our practice. Deeply into it. See that in each moment it is complete. Therefore, any reaction, any thought is irrelevant. This would be like cognitive behavioral therapy. I can have a thought about it, but it doesn't matter. It's done. It's completely done. If it's completely done, and it couldn't be any other way, then that is the very deepest definition of what word we might use, perfection. It is perfectly, completely, utterly done. Now I am free to let go of my entanglement with it and see what it is shining, which is, in a sense, its source. Its source. If we went all the way back to the source of the universe, according to physicists, the source of the universe was something called a singularity. It was neither big nor small. It had no front or back. There were no distinctions at all. There's no place for any distinctions, but it simply was. It was the capacity for the entire universe to appear. It was, in a sense, the source, with a capital S, the beginning of everything. And though it spread out, and though it differentiated, and though it became trees and people and cars and rooms and Zen and all the rest of it, it never stopped being what it originally was. Which was, it was, it is. This is the source. Very simple, very direct. To get there, we have to, too, become very simple. We have to see things just absolutely directly. It's already that way. It's already that way. It's just what we add that makes it difficult. If we were to subtract the ideas, subtract the preferences, subtract the names. Simply seeing them is irrelevant. They're there, but they're no different than sounds and smells. So we just let go of them and come back to the actuality of our experience. It's obvious. You can't ignore it. You can't not see it. It's there. So this is this seeing the ox. Then the next picture. This is the fourth picture. It's catching the ox. So today he encountered the ox, which has long been cavorting in the wild fields, and actually grasped it. For so long, a time. This has reveled in its surroundings that breaking it of its old habits is not easy. Okay, so I'm going to read that again. Today encountered the ox, which has long been cavorting in the wild fields, and actually grasped it. For so long a time has it been reveling in the surroundings, and breaking of its old habits is not easy. It continues to yearn for sweet-scented grasses. It is still stubborn and unbridled. If he would but tame it completely, the man must use his whip. And then it says here, he must tightly grasp the rope and not let go, for the ox still has unhealthy tendencies. Now it charges up to the highlands. Now it loiters in the misty ravine. Now it thinks it's incredibly special. Now it forgets and attaches with something in the past, some old idea of itself. Even though we come to this, it's not easy to let go of these old habits of thinking and feeling. So we must continue our zazen. We must hold, as they say, the nose ring tight. Stay very clear about this. Now this source is, in fact, you. The deepest you. The self with a capital S. One way it's been put is the center of the universe is everywhere. Einstein said this. Every point in the universe is the center of the universe. Therefore, each and every one of us is the center of the universe. Someone else said the center is everywhere and the circumference is nowhere in particular. Center is everywhere. The circumference is nowhere in particular. So first we see this shining from things. Then we say, what is it? This world is absolutely intimate. It cannot be even for one moment apart from the center. This world cannot for one moment depart from the center. It is always in the center. And yet, these thoughts come back. So we move to the fifth picture, and this is taming the ox. And this is just going back to exactly how we started. So even though you come to the point of seeing this clearly, you must continually deal with the thoughts that arise as deep habit patterns. One thought and another arises. Enlightenment brings the realization that such thoughts are not unreal, since even they arise from our true nature. It is only because delusion still remains that they are imagined to be unreal. This state of delusion does not originate in the objective world, but in our own minds. So this is a critical, critical point. The thinking is true nature. Thinking is the source. You can't separate even that out. It's only the meaning we give that is created by our own minds in a delusory way, based on what we've been taught, what we learn, what we attach to. But the thoughts themselves simply come from this one true source of am. And as sensation, in any moment, they are already done. Therefore, they do not require any intervention, any entanglement. You don't need to contradict them. You don't need to fight them. You don't need to push them away. Simply see them again as shining this one am, just as everything else does. We need to continually come back to this awareness. So this entire practice is about dealing with thinking, learning how to bring it into the sensations of each moment, which are complete, which shine this truth that is never, ever for a moment separate from the center. This is the essence of this practice. So I think we've reached the end of our talk, and we'll end here right now. I'll do some kinyin.